It's good to see everybody tonight. When the time was getting very low last week, I was going to take you to chapter 1, saying that when it tells us that Samuel lived in Ramah, we're going to go back to chapter 1. This is in chapter 7, verse 17. Go back to chapter 1, verse 1. And then as I thought about it and had about 20 seconds or 30, I said, this is not worth it. We'll go somewhere else. So I just start with that this time. Chapter 1, verse 1, if you will remember, says there was a certain man of Ramathaim Zophim. That word Ramathaim is the same as the word in verse 19. He lived in Ramathaim, but he lived in Ramah. Ramah is just the short form of it. And so the very first verse of the book is the simple point we were trying to make as to where Samuel lived, and he would go in this circuit judging people. In chapter 8, we have one of the saddest chapters in all the Scripture. And it's because of the people's unwillingness to let God be their ruler. And they may not even have known that was the ultimate consequence of the request they made. But knowing it or not, they were either belligerent or ignorant or somewhere with a mixture of both of those. As you look at this, you have in the first couple of verses the rejection. They reject Samuel, they reject Samuel's sons, and actually they reject God, as we'll see as we go along. Then they make a request, verses 3 through 5. We want a king like all the other nations about us. In verses 6 through 9, God's response is, okay, give them what they wanted, which can be the most frightening thing God can do. It would be very peaceful on our part if God would say no to everything we don't need. But if He says, if that's what you want and that's what you're going to do, then do it. That's very frightening because all of us, I suppose, could look back at times we prayed that a certain thing would turn out this way or that way. And then later, after maturity and after realizing the consequences and things we didn't see at the time, we realized that was the worst thing that could have happened to us. It could have destroyed us more than one way. So we're grateful when God says no. That is an answer. And it is a very good answer, but we have to trust Him when He says no. And then in verses 10 to 28, He says, I want you to realize what you're asking. Don't say you weren't warned. And so He goes down a list of some 10 or so, maybe 9 plus 1, but 9 plus 1 and a half or 10 reasons why they may regret this question, will you give us a king? Verses 19 to 22, the result is they now are going to have a king. He sends them all home. It doesn't happen immediately. Ever since Exodus 3, when God chose a leader in Moses, and that leader was so reluctant, he didn't want to go to Egypt. Ever since Exodus 3, all the way through the Judges, all the way up to this chapter, God has been the ruler, the recognized leader of His people. There was an occasion or two where there were bumps in the road. You remember in Judges chapter 8, after Gideon had played the hero and had done his duty very well, in Judges 8 verse 22, the people of Israel said to him, "Rule over us, both you and your son and your grandson also, for you have delivered us from the hand of Midian." A couple of things wrong with that. Number one, that's the same basic request you have in 1 Samuel 8. God is their ruler. And number two, they're giving Gideon way too much credit. Just breaking a few lanterns and shouting the sword of the Lord. And if Gideon doesn't merit the greatest generalship you've ever seen. Now, he does pursue them. He does his job that way. But it's not that he conquered the enemy. It's that God conquered them and He used the people of Israel in order to bring that about. And His response, though, is a good one. In verse 23, He said, "I will not rule over you, nor shall my son rule over you. The Lord shall rule over you." That's an A++. That just could not be a better answer that He gave them on this occasion. Now, that's the same answer Samuel would have given them. You have a little glitch here when Abimelech, the non-judge, but the one who runs for the office of king and manages to be a king for a few years, he actually serves as a king in a rather limited area. It shows what an unmitigated disaster that was. It wasn't something that would make a person stand aside and say, you know, that turned out very well. Let's just see if we can't get another one. It taught them that having a king is not necessarily the best thing you want for you or your people. And now time's passed. We're at the time when Samuel has made an impact spiritually on these people. And the result is they say, we need us a king like all the other nations. God has been their leader, and now he is shoved to the side. Almost invariably, when people start making requests of this type, there's a problem that seems to justify the request. Let's look at the first five verses. Now, it came to pass when Samuel was old that he made his sons judges over Israel. The name of his firstborn was Joel, the name of his second Abijah, and they were judges in Beersheba. But his sons did not walk in his ways. They turned aside after dishonest gain, took bribes, and perverted justice. Then all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah, which we saw in 7:17 is his home. And in verse 5, they said to him, "Look, you are old, and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now make us a king to judge us like all the nations." Well, that displeased Samuel. It displeased God more. Samuel said, "I've been fired." God says, "No, actually, I have been fired," in their minds. Now, as you look at the problems here, they bring up Samuel's age. A person, if he doesn't die, he grows old. And they said, "We need someone with youth and vigor who can lead armies out." Samuel's apparently to the point that he can't do this anymore. To complicate matters, he has had these two sons that, for whatever reason, didn't follow after their father's footsteps. In verse 1, when he was old, he made his sons judges. And then in verse 2, he mentions their names, and they were judges in Beersheba. And in verse 3, they're not chips off the old block. These boys do not walk in the ways of their father. Now, they turn aside after, and it mentions three things: dishonest gain, meaning if they're going to serve as judge, the one with the most money and who's willing to share that money and bribe is going to get the verdict in his favor. So they went after dishonest gain. They're not about the law. They're about the lucre, the filthy lucre. They took bribes and they perverted justice. More about this in a moment. We raise the question, why was it? Two things we have to ask here. Number one, why was it that after Samuel has seen the debacle with Eli's boys, does he turn around and basically have a repetition of that? Would he not have been more on his guard than anybody else, having seen what happened with Eli's sons? That did not end well. You don't want your sons to end that way, not only because of them, but because of you. Eli didn't end well. And neither will Samuel if this goes on, if he's not trying to stop it. There's a lot about this we don't know because it doesn't go into the same detail it did with Eli and his sons. But the end result is they're not following in the ways they should. Then the second question is, when you look at the situation with him and his sons, you raise the question, why did they not turn after his ways? Was he gone so much? We've just seen in chapter 7, in verse 16, this circuit he went on. He went on this circuit from year to year, on a circuit to Bethel, Gilgal, and Mizpah, and judged Israel in all those places. I remember Exodus 18, when Moses is judging his people, he sits from morning till night, and his father-in-law takes him aside. He happens to be there at this time. He says, "You're wearing yourself out. This is not going to work. You need to appoint men over you, men who can judge 1,000, then 100 and then 10, and separate these, and the bigger cases go up and up like they do in the Supreme Court, and you can settle those, but don't try to do all this by yourself." And it was very good advice, and Moses took that advice, and maybe it helped him live longer. I don't know. He lived to be 120. But is it possible that Samuel got so involved in the Lord's work that he neglected the children that God gave him? Now, I can't answer that. I don't know if that's the case, or if there were other influences, sinister influences upon them that he didn't know anything about that brought them down without his knowledge. I have no clue. I just know that is the result. So that in verse 4, all the elders of Israel gathered together and they came to Samuel at his home. You can imagine what a meeting this would have been. It says these two sons are at Beersheba. Samuel didn't learn from Eli. He goes to Beersheba. His sons do. Now notice, he's up here in Ramah between Mizpah and Gibeah. Here's Mizpah and here's Gibeah. So Ramah would be right about there. Here's Beersheba down here. So these sons, After the capture of a lot of the Philistine territory, this area that had been owned by the Philistines is now owned by Israel. And so maybe it opened up a new avenue for them to go to in order to need judges there when the Israelites have filled this vacuum left by the fleeing Philistines. That's more than I know. But at any rate, that's what takes place. And then they have this desire and this question, not only to talk about his age and his son's behavior, but to state their real goal, and it would have been their goal whether these other two things had been a real problem or not. This is what they want. In verse 4, they gather and come to Ramah, and they say to him, "Look, you are old, and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now make us a king to judge us like all the nations." Okay. The desire to be like the world is what Satan wants. And one of the means by which Satan helps a person who's otherwise a very godly man in many ways, these are elders asking. You would assume they're spiritually more mature than others who weren't to their level. But Satan can use a problem or problems to fuel apostasy. And you see this so many times in the history of the church as well as in the Bible itself. You'll see occasion after occasion where the problem causes people to overreact or to misreact. And as a result, they go off into error. Now, when the cure is worse than the illness, something's wrong. Just to illustrate this, when George Washington lay dying, he had a severe cold, probably a little more than that. But they at that time, they said the thing to do is bleed him. He's got too much blood in his body. And they drained 4 pints. And it's believed that, actually 5 pints, it was 4 times they drained these 5 pints of blood. And he got weaker and weaker and weaker, and he died. And here's a problem he has. If they had given him an antibiotic, which weren't around back then, that could have taken care of this minor thing. But they had no such thing. And then bleeding him and doing a few other things that I won't even go into, it was horrible. And so he died a very miserable death. The cure was worse than the illness. He died of the bloodletting and the other things they did to him. You see this spiritually as well. In Genesis 27, for example, when Jacob goes in and deceives his father, he lies, and in the name of the Lord, he says, "Yes, I am Esau." Why does he do it? Well, he wants to have this great spiritual blessing. So he tells a horrible lie using the Lord's name to confirm it in order to get a spiritual blessing. There's something terribly wrong with that, isn't there? And God had promised in chapter 25, verse 23, the younger would be the ruler, the older would serve the younger, and Esau was a little older. Or you can notice in chapter 34 when Dinah is compromised by Shechem. What does Simeon do? What does Levi do? Well, they go in after they have these men. They say, "You have to be circumcised if we're going to intermarry with you and trade." And so they go back and they agree to this. And on the third day, they go in when they're hospitalized for all intents and purposes, and they utterly slay them and take everything that's in the city. It is incredible, the cruelty. Because of this, Simeon and Levi are on the no blessing list. When you read Genesis 48, you see what Jacob said to them, they seem to have gotten the last word when he rebuffs them. He says, "You've made me a criminal in the midst of all these people around." And they said, "Is he going to violate our sister this way?" And it seemed they had the last word till it came his deathbed, and he's making his final words to them, and then he leaves both of them out of the will, basically. And it's only until you see in Exodus 32 that the Levites stand with Moses and they go about and they slay the ones who aren't doing the Lord's will, that the Levites are put again into a place of notoriety and a high position with God. And Simeon, he becomes a part of Judah and is just swallowed up by it eventually and just goes smaller and smaller. So God is saying there, don't make the cure worse than the actual problem was to start with. You see the same thing in Luke 9. You remember, we won't take the time to go there because the clock is already being very ugly. But in Luke 9, James and John, passing through Samaria, don't receive a welcome from these people. They say, "If you're on the way to Jerusalem, you can't stay with us." They're trying to find lodging for Jesus. So they come back and they say, "Jesus, Do you want us to go and call fire down from heaven on those people and burn them up because they wouldn't take us into their houses? And he says, that's not my purpose to go around burning people up. What kind of a spirit do you have here? Their cure was worse than the original problem. It's bad enough to show hospitality, but it's even worse to murder people and indiscriminately murder people. In Acts 6, Greg took us through this just a few weeks ago. I don't know that it's a sin to make a mistake and to inadvertently overlook something. Have you ever done that? If that's a sin, then I'm in trouble. But I know it's a sin to murmur. And when they go off murmuring about something that was an honest mistake, they did not intend to do it, to neglect those widows, then you've got the cure that's worse than the problem. And we can multiply these, but I think you see the issue here. So, is there a problem in Israel? Yes. Is Samuel getting too old to provide military leadership? Maybe he needs to confine himself to civil issues? Maybe so. That happens. Is it true that his sons aren't worthy of any type of leadership position in Israel? That's absolutely true. All these charges are true. No one can deny them. So they say, well, that means then we need a king like all the other nations. Where did that come from? That's not the only way to solve this problem. But it's one they lighted upon because it's what they wanted. Now, let me play with you for a moment and see if I can find some good motivation behind their request for a king. I think we can make some of these look pretty good. And in fact, some of them are true. In the first place, Israel is now at their greatest spiritual level in all the time of the judges. Samuel's still a judge. You're still technically in that judge period just before the kingdom period begins. Because of Samuel, they've been raised to this level, but because they have been raised to this level and they know more than they should, yet they haven't arrived yet, they bring up these issues. These are problems. We want to deal with this like we should have dealt with Eli's sons. So that's good. They fear they may relapse into sin. I mean, if you let these sons go on, they may be every bit as bad as Eli's boys were. And we don't want that again. You saw the calamity that brought upon our nation, right? We have to deal with this right now. And people begin to panic. Samuel's sons might be their undoing again. They won't be on the wrong side of God. God had promised kings. Now, this to me would be their greatest argument. And it's true. He had promised kings. Let's go through this very, very quickly. I can't take you through all of these in any detail. But back in Genesis 17, you'll recall this statement that God makes to Abram when he's 99 years old and he still doesn't have a son. In verse 6, he says, I will make you exceedingly fruitful. He didn't even have a child yet. And I will make nations of you. Now get this. And kings shall come from you. Skip down to verse 16. He speaks of Sarah. Her name changes from Sarai to Sarah. And he says, I will bless her and also give you a son by her. Then I will bless her and she shall be a mother of nations. Kings of peoples shall be from her. If she's a princess, typically when princesses have a firstborn, he becomes a king. And that's what would be the wordplay here. In chapter 35, verse 11. You see in this discussion to Jacob, he receives the same blessing. God said to him, Genesis 35:11. The passages are all up there in case I go a little fast. A couple of them may not be up there, but this one is. God said to him, I'm God Almighty, be fruitful and multiply. A nation and a company of nations shall proceed from you, and kings shall come from your body. Well, we're starting to get familiar with this promise. Chapter 49, verse 10. I don't think this one is up there. I've debated about how many I would actually use. This one won out. In 49 verse 9, Judah is a lion's whelp. He goes on to talk about him. And then in verse 10, the scepter. What's a scepter?
King's staff.
King's staff, yeah. Will not depart from Judah. That means rule. That means dominion. Nor a lawgiver from between his feet until Shiloh comes, and to him shall be the obedience of the people. Numbers 24 verse 17. Well, that is up there. Numbers 24. And as you look at verse 17, this is Balaam speaking. And instead of cursing Israel, he makes a messianic prophecy. In verse 17, I see him, but not now. I behold him, but not near. A star shall come out of Jacob. A scepter shall rise out of Israel. And he talks about how he would rule. Then Deuteronomy 17, one of the most significant of all these passages. Verse 14. When you come to the land which the Lord your God is giving you and possess it, and dwell in it and say, I will set a king over me like all the nations that are around me. Now notice, he's talking about what he's going to allow, but not necessarily what he approves of. Yes. But he says, I will say that you'll set this king over you whom the Lord your God chooses. And that God would choose Saul, he would choose David, and so on. So that's all historically accurate. One from among your brethren, you shall set his king over you. You may not set a foreigner over you who is not your brother. Then he talked about what he's not to do. We've seen this, verses 16 and 17, that he's not to multiply horses. 17, he's not to multiply wives. 17, he's not to multiply silver and gold. Then verse 18, it shall be when he sits on the throne of his kingdom, he shall write for himself a copy of this law. He doesn't go out to a bookstore or order it online and get a Bible. He writes it out. He writes out that this book of the law from one before the priests, the Levites, and it shall be with him. He shall read it all the days of his life, that he may learn to fear the Lord his God and be careful to observe all the words of this law and these statutes. Pause here. David not only read these scriptures, but wrote these scriptures, many of the Psalms and others. But verse 20, what's the purpose of this? Here's the kind of king God would use, and this is segueing into the idea that there would be a king, namely David, not Saul, that would be God's choice, that would be a type, any type relationship that Jesus would fulfill. So there would have to be a king after God's own choosing to fulfill that, but not according to the request of these people. Their request is, make us like all the other nations. God's purpose is, here's a king that will set you as a pattern, David, to show you what you can expect when the Messiah comes. So two beautiful contrasts here between the people and what God would do. Verse 20, that his heart may not be lifted above his brethren, that he may not turn aside from the commandment to the right hand or the left, and that he may prolong his days in his kingdom, he and his children in the midst of Israel. Now if you go to Acts 13, verse 20, what you begin to see in the New Testament, we'll go backwards in doing this, Acts 13, Paul's preaching in Antioch of Pisidia. In verse 20, he's going over history, and this is a sermon very similar to what we're studying on Sunday morning with Stephen, only here's Paul doing it. Verse 20, after that he gave them judges for about 450 years until Samuel the prophet. And afterward they asked for a king. Well, that's where we are. That's 1 Samuel 8. So God gave them Saul the son of Kish, a man of the tribe of Benjamin, for 40 years. And when he had removed him, he raised up for them David. So he got rid of Saul. He gave them someone after his own heart. And so he gave them David as king, to whom also he gave this testimony, that he will do all my will. For from this man's seed, according to the promise, God raised up for Israel a Savior, Jesus. And then in Acts 2, we're very familiar with this one, when he says in verse 29, now when David makes these statements in Psalm 16, he's not referring to himself. His body has decayed, his sepulcher is still with us. But verse 30, therefore being a prophet. David wrote this as a prophet, not an autobiography. It's a prophet. Knowing that God had sworn with an oath to him that of the fruit of his body, according to the flesh, he would raise up the Christ to do what? To sit on his throne. So he sits on David's throne. What does that mean? Is he in heaven sitting on the literal throne that David sat on earth? No. But he rules, and David was a type of the ruler Jesus would be. And he goes on to speak of this. And then as you go on back a little further, we're having to cut out some of what we could have said. 2 Samuel chapter 7. 2 Samuel 7. David asks God for a house. He wants to be able to build God a house. Give me this privilege to build a temple. And God says, no, you cannot do this. I'm going to build you a house. And he means, it's a play on words, he means a dynasty. Kingdom. And it will last forever. Of course, with people, that wouldn't be. But in verse 12, when your days are fulfilled, when you rest with your fathers, I will set up your seed after you, who will come from your body, and I will establish his kingdom. He shall build a house for my name. I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. I will be his father. He shall be my son. So you have it. This is segueing back and forth between Solomon, the first fulfillment, and Christ, the ultimate reality of this fulfillment. And then verse 16, your house and your kingdom should be established forever. Your throne should be established forever. Ezekiel 34, very quickly. And Isaiah 9, we could go to Isaiah 9. I'm very tempted to still, but I probably won't. Ezekiel 34. We have this language that caused the Messiah, David, so similar in their role would they be that he can say David and mean the Messiah. Okay, Ezekiel 34 and verse 23. I will establish one shepherd over them, and he shall feed them, my servant David. Now, the premillennialist says, well, that means David's going to be resurrected and come back and sit on his throne. Oh, is that right? This literal David. Well, he says there'd be one who would rule. So if it's literal David, Christ doesn't get his turn, does he? Just one. But he doesn't mean David when he says David here. He's like Elijah in Malachi 3 and 4. He's not referring to Elijah, he's referring to John. When he says David, he means Christ. It's very simple. Okay, so he says, my servant David, he shall feed them and be their shepherd. And I, the Lord, will be their God, and my servant David, a prince among them. I, the Lord, have spoken. And you'll notice here, 37, verse 25, this David, he mentions him in verse 24, 37, 24. David, my servant, shall be king over them. They shall all have one shepherd. They shall walk in my judgments and observe my statutes and do them. Verse 25, then they shall dwell in the land that I've given to Jacob my servant, where your fathers dwelt, and they shall dwell there, they, their children, and their children's children forever. And my servant David shall be their prince forever. If David's their prince forever, Jesus doesn't get his turn. Obviously, that won't work even with the premillennial era. This is referring to Christ, the Messiah, who is like David. David's like the Messiah. Okay, that's a whole lot in a short time. Any comments? Any comments? Okay. That took a while, but these are absolutely important passages that we have to have under our belt if we're going to understand some of these prophecies that are given. Okay, do you see why, if you were an elder and you know these, and I'm not saying they did know them, by the way, I would really question that. And if they did know them, I'd question if they interpreted them correctly, and some of those passages weren't even written by 1 Samuel 8. But if they did, can you see how they may say, well, here's what we want. We want a king like you promised. And if they'd said that, it may not have been so bad. But it's, no, we want a king to be like all the other nations. That's the kind of king they want, and it's the motive they have for asking. And they're wrong on both counts. Everybody see that? Any comments? I'm going very quickly. Miss Joy.
To me, it's kind of funny, you know, like the judges and then the judges' sons were such a disaster.
Yes.
So then you say, well, give us a king who's a permanent line, and we're just going to follow along with those sons, and then we can't even do anything about it.
And it's not as if a king can't have a rotten son, is it? That's typical. Yeah, so excellent point. Did somebody, Tim?
Mm-hmm. It must be that God approves of that
proposition. I don't doubt it. I don't doubt it. Ignorance comes up with things like that. Yes. Anybody else have a hand? Steve.
Obviously, I'm thinking about those reasons that they're impossible logic. It's kind of dismissed because they do reveal themselves. It's like the rest of the nations. It wasn't because, well, this was prophesied of old, we're ready for it, or anything like this. They just simply said because the other nations.
That's ungetoverable. I guess that's a real word, isn't it? Ungetoverable. You know what I mean anyway, right? Any others? Okay. So, the motivation. Here's the motivation. These are worldly excuses. Aging Eli and his sons, corruption, so we have to do something to fix the system. It's broke. They refused to wait for God's timing. If they had said, Lord, you said we're going to have a king to rule over us, so you have any idea when that'll be? Just asking. If it's not my business, tell me so. But nothing like that. No, we want a king to be like these other nations. And like all the other nations, the solution, like we saw a moment ago, is far worse than the original problem. But Joy mentioned some of that. They demand fallible human leadership. They demand a fallible human leader over God. God never made a mistake. Look at chapter 7. While he ruled over the Philistines. He owned them. They were running from him. It's a great victory. Here I raise my Ebenezer. The Lord has been my helper, and his stone will help us remember. They forgot the very next chapter. The very next chapter, they forgot all about Ebenezer. Their ingratitude is stinky. It's one of those situations where God has blessed them beyond their ability to comprehend, and they don't even appreciate it. And then we would be remiss not to go to Hosea for just a moment. Hosea 1 at verse 4, then we'll skip to the end of the book. Hosea 1:4. This is a beautiful book with a lot of ugly sins of Israel portrayed through it. Hosea takes his wife Gomer. She bears him a son. Verse 4, the Lord said to him, call his name Jezreel. It means God scatters. For in a little while, I will avenge the bloodshed of Jezreel on the house of Jehu and bring an end to the kingdom of the house of Israel. You know what that means? I'm going to send Assyria, and they're going to destroy the northern 10 tribes. They're going to take them. What few are left are going to go into exile. Now go over to the last part of the book. Hosea 13. Now, in verse 9. O Israel, you are destroyed, but your help is from me. I will be your king. Where is any other? Oh, that says it all, doesn't it? Look at two things here. He's saying in the first part of verse 9, you are destroyed. He's saying, when your red light comes on your dashboard, you don't just keep going and just try to beat the light out, do you? You better listen to the light. All right, he says, your light is on and disaster is impending. You better listen. Verse 10, I will be your king. If they had turned to God at this moment and said, yes, we want you to be our king. And he says, where is any other? It's foolish to trust in any other. And that's what Israel is trying to do. Where is any other that he may save you in all your cities? And your judges to whom you said, give me a king and princes. Listen to verse 11. I gave you a king in my anger and took him away in my wrath. Need we say more? You rejected me. And I said, okay, it's fine. I will give you what you ask for. You better be careful what you ask for. You just might get it. Right, Ty?
I've always been a little puzzled I can see the rejection of God and maybe to Samuel and asking for a king. But I always thought, couldn't God give direction to the kings like he gave to the judges? But then the more I wonder, is he able to, in a sense that might remove a little bit of free will, like he can... For the judges, he could identify or raise up, in a sense, people, men that he knew were going, or men or women whom he knew were going to lead the way he wants them to, and then give them some additional direction. But a king's going to do what a king wants to do a lot of the time, that we saw that.
That's what he goes on to say. He gives him a 10-lesson course on what having a king means. Yes.
So, I mean, that's basically it, then. A king is... be removing free will.
Yes, yeah, that's right. Go back to Abimelech. What did Abimelech do? Was he a nightmare or a pleasant dream? He was a nightmare. And God could have removed his free will, but he doesn't do that at any time. And so that when they're asking for a king, that's what they're going to get.
And it's a line. It's a line, like Joy was saying, it's a succession.
It is a succession. Unless somebody murders, you have, right. What, 9 murders in the northern kingdom, but the southern kingdom just flows right through, except for Athaliah. All legitimate heirs, and yet rotten as they can be for the most part, with very few exceptions.
That's kind of an interesting insight into the nature of God, that he doesn't, he's taking issue with it because it makes it so much more challenging for things to go the way that they're supposed to.
Exactly, and the people are basically getting what they deserve when they ask for a king and live in this way. That's right. Any others? Great.
You know, when we are praying for people, it's they're a really great point. It's a good discussion to talk about free will. We have free will. But when we pray for people and we pray for that something could be done to change their behavior, what we're doing is asking for God's providence to put his heavy hand upon them or to use providential means in which to get them to change their behavior or to be able to really see clearly what's going on. We don't ask them to change their will.
No, you can't do that. That's impossible. Exactly.
But we're looking for ways providentially that you can change things.
There are occasions when, like the prodigal son, the father's praying for him. He says, I hope he goes ragged. I hope he goes hungry. And not because he doesn't love him, but because he wants him to see what he had and what he's missing.
Yeah. Providentially, the pig sty was the best thing that could have ever happened.
Could not have been better. Yes. I totally agree. Any others? Okay. Well, as you look at the refusal to wait for God's timing, all these things they do, this is just not a good situation. Now look at verse 6. We're told, this thing displeased Samuel when they said, give us a king to judge us. So Samuel prayed to the Lord. Does Samuel have hurt feelings? Well, yes, he does. What does he do with his hurt feelings? He goes to God in prayer. What an example this man is. Even in these moments of very tense stress, he goes to the Lord in prayer. Now, the people, to be honest, are right to reject his sons, but they overstate their case, they misstate their case, and they go down the wrong track. In verse 7, the Lord said to Samuel, heed the voice of the people in all that they say to you, for they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me. In the Semitic absolutes, they would, the way the Jews would state things, they'd state them as an absolute. They've not rejected you. Well, they did, but not. That's not the main thing. The main thing is they've rejected me, God says. And he says that I should not reign over them. God, as early as Exodus 15:18, is the one who rules his nation. And they're ignoring all of this. Then verse 8. According to all the works which they have done since the day that I brought them up out of Egypt, even to this day, with which they have forsaken me and served other gods, so they're doing to you also. You know what he's saying in verse 8? What I see in the children of Israel at this point is nothing new. They've done it ever since I rescued them out of Egypt. So this is just par for the course. And it gets worse when you go to John 19. And Pilate says, shall I crucify your king? And what's the Jewish response? We have no king but Caesar. This man's not our king. Well, in verse 9, now therefore heed their voice. However, you shall solemnly forewarn them. This means they can't plead ignorance. You shall solemnly forewarn them and show them the behavior of the king who will reign over them. You know what the behavior of the king is? It's arbitrary, it's absolute, and it's capricious. Whatever he wants to do, he does. And who's going to stop him? There's nobody higher than him except God. That's what they've asked for. And so when Saul starts doing what he does, and he won't even let his soldiers eat when they're starving to help fight the Philistines and all these things, these arbitrary, capricious rules. He's not a general. He doesn't know the best way to lead troops. His son Jonathan knew more than he did. David knew more than he did. But this is what you get. Saul is good looking and he's tall. From head and shoulders up, he's the tallest one in the land. You want a king like all the other nations, they're looking for somebody big who can lead us against our enemy. He sure does look like the man. And it's all physical and nothing to do with spiritual, which is really what made them where they are today. Spiritual. And that leads us then to verse 10. So Samuel told all the words of the Lord to the people who asked him for a king. Now, just very quickly, answered prayer can be a very good thing. It is in some passages, as you see in chapter 7, verse 8, they pray that Samuel will pray for them to win against Philistines, and he does. It's a bad thing here when they're praying that God will give them a king. Be careful what you ask for is what Jesus is teaching James and John. You want the right hand and left in my kingdom. Do you really know what you're asking for? You want to be on that cross and this cross with me in the middle? Is that what they thought they were asking for? And then God permitted what he didn't approve. And he will permit us. If we want to go the wrong way, he will let us go the wrong way. He'll do it with tears and hopefully with reproof. But he'll let us do it. People can't tolerate the apostasy of Samuel's sons, but they see no wrong in their own apostasy in making this very request. And that's really sad. Evil kings would rule for centuries. And as Joy has already pointed out, they'll have bad sons. And you'll see this in the history of Judah and Israel, who will do all kinds of terrible things. Okay, any comments? Okay, Steve and then Ty. That's an attractive option, and what I meant to say something about it. They're down in Beersheba. He's up in Ramah. It's likely that it would have been very hard to hear about that, and I don't know how long that had been. So it's a possibility. I wouldn't discount it. And then, Ty?
You know, it's funny, verse 6, they're saying, give us a king to judge us. It's like they got the concept of a king, but then they're thinking the king's going to judge them like a judge and going to lead them into battle like a judge. And then you know, Samuel goes through all the things, the Lord, you know, this isn't how a king's going to be.
No.
It's almost like a child asking for, I want a dog to play with. And then mom's like, do you realize the responsibilities? Do you realize the things that come along? I want a dog to play with. And even at the end, they say we want a king that will judge us and go out before us and fight our battles. They didn't realize he's going to rule them with a heavy hand.
Yeah.
It's like they're completely ignoring everything that's being said. They've got blinders on.
The sixth grader is the star of his football team. He says, I'd like nothing better than to play right now against any professional player you put up against me. Yeah. What's going to happen? He's going to be smashed. Yeah. Any others? Appreciate your comments.